Welcome to Season 6 of Game Design Unboxed on the No Direction Network. Danielle Reynolds talks to tabletop game designers about the games they've made. Together, they unbox how the game went from inspiration to publication.
If you're a fan of AllPlay, find them at Gen Con. They will be at booth 1849 in the Expo Hall, as well as at Event Room 140. They have some awesome games releasing, including Twinkle Twinkle, Merchants of Andromeda, Waddle, Soda Jerk, and Llama Llama, many of which I've gotten a chance to play and really enjoy, especially the soda one. That was super fun beating Joe at it. They also have another booth in the stadium with events like Ammon Anderson's How to Play Twinkle Twinkle, where you get to learn the game right from my bud, the designer, and walk away with a bundle full of games for just $58 versus the $62 you would have gotten had you been stuck in line waiting at the booth in the expo hall. These bundles are going to be held for purchase with the event ticket from Gen Con Events. So come demo some AllPlay games and make sure to say hey to me if you see me running around Gen Con. Thank you for joining me, Danielle, for Game Design Unboxed, Inspiration to Publication, Episode 120, Chu. Today, we are joined by Peter Petrucha, Creative Director of Imaging Games, as well as you do a lot of design and developing for the publishing company as well. Thanks for being on the show.
Thanks for having me.
I am a massive comic book fan, and it's really cool to see that you worked to bring an award-winning Image comic book over into the RPG space.
I've been talking a lot with one of the co-creators like the last few days, Rob Guillory, who did all of the art. This was like where they got their start in comics. They were that young upstart that got brought up, and they won like an Eisner for like New Best Artist, which is like, you know, like we have the Ennies in the RPG side, right? But they have the Eisner. So it's really cool too, because it's like this gift to give them an Emmy award and to be like, hey, check this out. And then when they're like blown away by what you did with their stuff, it's really fun. And that's the beauty of this indie thing, right? Of like, it's not Viacom. Like I'm dealing with two other creators who broke out and did their thing, you know? So it's been a blast.
So before we get into that, let's hear a little about you. Like, how did you get into game design and tell us about Imaging Games?
First of all, you are doing the thing that I kick myself all the time because I get all kinds of stuff that says imaging. And I'm always like, it's imagining. I'm imagining games. I want you to imagine games. I love when I get invoices and such. And it's, I'm like, it probably even got auto-corrected.
Mm-hmm.
My start in game design was really role-playing games just in my teenage years meant so much to me, from letting me immerse myself in different lives and different places, like playing games like Shadowrun and like experience what the future could be. And now living, you know, 20, 30 years later, looking at how much of that stuff happened that I almost experienced beforehand, had some idea of what that would look like. You would interface with your life with things like the internet before that was a thing for us. When I got in my 30s, I always liked role-playing games, but of course, I was like a teenager in the 90s, and I grew up at a game store. I lived there every day after school, so I got to play a lot of games, and it was always really impactful for me. A lot of my best friends came out of those games, and you know, you get the dynamics of being a better communicator and storyteller and creative and creating your own worlds and games and homebrews and stuff that makes you feel strong and empowered and confident for the rest of your life as you take these skills with you as you go forward. When I got to my 30s and realized I wasn't going to have a dot-com boom, it was like in a career, was really happy with my job but comfortable, I started looking at my life and going, well, what else would I like to do? Now that like, you know, I have a comfortable life, I have a nice house and family starting to become a thing. And when I really did some soul searching, I was like, you know, something that was always important to me is role-playing games. And I really thought a lot about who are you and how can you put that into something? I don't want to say it's like, what are you put here to do? But you know, there's an element of like looking at yourself honestly and being like, what have I spent so much of my life doing that I could really build or give back to? And I wanted to give back to role-playing games. I always had those people being like, why don't you go make video games? You know, because like parents didn't understand when we were younger and like role-playing games and tabletop wasn't anything. It wasn't anything. It was Monopoly to them. So anyway, long story short was just that I found myself around the 2015-16 area, going to conventions, going to workshops, kind of plotting different game designs. And then my first game was called Dream Chaser, A Game of Destiny. It's a game about visualizing success and also kind of goal setting. So it's almost like some self-help concepts that I mixed up with myth making and lore and made a story building game. I thought an answer to, we always tell people with role-playing games, you can be whoever you want to be and do whatever you want to do. Then we sit them at a table and then they have to be the cleric or the dwarf or the missing person. They have to be in a dungeon. You know, they have to go along with the ride. And I thought that we kind of missed the promise there of letting people kind of go write a New York Times bestseller or get to Gen Con or climb Mount Olympus or whatever. So.
Oh, that's super cool. And funny thing, your Rest in Pieces, like Jenga-ish game.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've actually played it. It was one of the first games I played when I started like learning hobby games because I just happened to have met someone locally at a library when I lived in Chicago.
If you could see my face, as you probably get that, you know, when somebody goes, I've played your game and you sound happy about it. So I'm just like, you know, my jaw drops, my eyes are big. I love it.
No, yeah, I was in like a review thingy of it, like a video that the board game captain did.
Oh yeah, that guy's so cool.
Yeah, he's super duper nice. But it was like really funny because I happened to meet him and that was like one of the first things I did when I lived locally. I lived like 20-ish minutes from him. And so he would like have me play these new games as a brand new gamer.
Josh Kaplan. Yeah, it took me a second.
Yeah, and he was like, hey, can you like do some reviews? And it's so funny because like I look very different in those videos than I do now. I have lost like 60 pounds. I am blonde and I am now a pretty decent designer in comparison to when I first started like learning about hobby games back then. But yeah, no, I've played your game.
I think you were even like a Rising Star Award winner or something. Did I see that from Play?
Yeah, I did. I won the Rising Star Award last year. So it was pretty cool.
Yeah. Congrats for you. Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah. That was pretty awesome.
Small world.
Fun fact, small world.
Yeah. I love that game for that reason. That so many people find it because it's one of the, this is one of those areas where I think we can have a really good discussion if we get to it. It's not chew related, but like I constantly find I don't have a problem blending different components that some people have always, especially like back in like the earlier 2000s, like, oh, you can't put cards in RPGs and why do you have a board here? And you know, these things that Rest in Pieces is just like, was a product of, I was at PAX Unplugged in 2017 for the first year, and I was selling my Dream Chaser game, and I was like trying to pitch to the, for people who haven't been to these shows, like PAX Unplugged is like a, was a very young, fresh audience who was very enthusiastic about tabletop, but we had a lot of people that first year who would look at our table of books, because I was with a co-op, the Indie Game Developer Network, and they would look at some things, and then one person would be like, oh, this is like D&D, but you play vampires. And some of us at the booth were scared because we're like, they don't even know what Vampire the Masquerade is. Like, you know, they said this is D&D if you could play vampires. So I was like, wow, I have this game that like you could read this 100-page book and play it like immediately, like no prep, like over, you could read it over a weekend and play it. But these people came and they were like, do you have anything we could play now? Because they were like card game players, you know, they were tabletop players. They wanted like, what can we play with our friends in the hallway? We're at PAX. And I was like, shit, what am I going to do about that? Rest in Peace is a lot of the core of what the product ended up being was an answer to that. Like, I was like, okay, if I don't want to lose those people, if I got to try to help RPGs keep those people in the RPG camp, I got to give them something that they can go buy right now in 20 minutes, be playing in the hallway, but role playing. You know, so Rest in Pieces was supposed to be like, you could play in an hour, you can just drop and play because it's got all the scenarios. And I thought it could be a great gateway. So I love hearing that you're like, oh yeah, it was kind of a part of my start. You know, it was meant to be that.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think technically that probably was my first RPG I ever played.
Oh my gosh. Did we just become best friends?
This is the start of our origin story. Yeah. The question is, are we superheroes or villains?
You know the answer to that.
That's true. This is amazing, but like, let's talk comic books. Chew is based off of one. So for anyone who's unfamiliar with the comic, I want you to kind of talk about that and then how you ended up creating a role-playing game for it.
Sure. Chew. Imagine a world, the creators would say like, it's always 5 years ago, because then you don't have the demands of today. But a world like ours, where the bird flu, and some of this is going to get too real, so I apologize, where the bird flu kills over 100 million people. Now, the funny part about this is over 20 million were in the U.S. So in this occasion, the U.S. actually gave a shit. They actually overreacted. Congress passes a poultry prohibition. So think like the Depression with alcohol. Drug dealers start egg dealing. The mob and Yakuza are chicken trafficking. Mm-hmm. Corporations are racing to make the next best chicken alternative, which leads to chicken frogs and stuff. And you play quirky members of like the most powerful law enforcement agency in the world now, the Food and Drug Administration. So like you are the men in black of the government. When everyone is like, they're going too far, the government has done it this time. You're the scary face of them. And you can like commandeer cars, order the police around, you know, like get away with murder, basically, because you have an abusive amount of authority. It's like they poured all the money into it and they haven't quite reined anyone in yet. The best part is you have like this work-life balance and you're these weird, quirky characters. There's different playbook types, we call them. Like you could be the mascot or the hotshot or the wronged. And it's also a world that's got food powers. So this is where it gets a little weird on top of weird. It's like, oh, you thought you knew what you're talking about. And then it gets weirder. People in this world, it's like kind of like an X-Men-like mutation. Some people have a rare thing where they can eat or cook a specific thing and have an odd ability. So like one of my favorite guys, he's like a Russian bodybuilder. And every meatball that he places in a pool of spaghetti on his head, he is that many men strong. But anybody could walk over and pluck a meatball or knock it off his head, he would immediately be like, no, my power. So the title character is Tony Chu. And then there's a whole other angle where, I mean, this Chu is a gem. We've always said, if you don't know Chu, if you do, you love Chu. It managed to be one of those few things that's like a little bit of something for everybody that you don't quite ever pull off trying to do that. It just sometimes happens. Yeah, and it like blew up as the alt comic around 2010 of like people would go to the comic book shop and be like, hey, my friend or my partner or my spouse, they're not really into superheroes. You got anything for them while I'm over here geeking out? And Chu became that handoff. It was this quirky, weird thing. I love that the title pitch line kind of thing is it's a foodie crime drama about cops, crooks, cooks, cannibals, and clairvoyance in a clucked up world.
I love the clucked up world ending.
Yeah. And a foodie crime drama just begs for more because we're all foodies. We're like, what? Well, foodie.
Yeah.
One of the best things about the game is, and in the comics, is just the weird powers. Like, maybe if you and I are both eating a Snickers, I can, like, show you the maps that I've seen in actual, like, in my life. Or I can cook you a meal, like a murder mystery, and everyone at the table, as they're biting into the dessert, they can either hear a concert, or they can imagine the taste that I imbued into the food, or I could break down in their mind the explosion of food taste is actually the thought of who did it and how they did it, and they could see it as vivid as if they were there. These powers aren't like Superman. They're not going to make you invincible or let you fly. They're going to give you weird, quirky abilities that you're going to have to like really roleplay to set up, but the payoff is going to be wonderful.
That's amazing. That makes me think of those Twix commercials where it's like, if you need a moment, like take a Twix. And so it's like, you have a Twix and now like pauses the whole world.
100%. You can just call it, right? That like, you know, some GM is letting that happen, right? I had somebody who's not so fast ramen was their thing. And it did something similar to that. As long as they were eating from the bowl of ramen, the whole world was slowing, but they had to be constantly eating, right?
So like, they're just like low-key slurping the longest noodle ever.
Yeah, you get all kinds of great stuff. One of my favorites, and that's the last one I'll leave, is that somebody in the setups, because role-playing games, somebody was like, I hit my belt and I pressed the button on the side. I'm like, okay, well, what does that do? It's like a Hungry Man TV dinner or Hungry Jack TV dinner pops into my hand, spring loaded. I was like, what? And I'm just laughing at this point. And they're like, yeah. So I peel that shit back and I scoop out the mashed potatoes, because they have this power where they can like make real sort of like almost drones or like golems out of mashed potatoes. But anybody could like squish them, right? They're just mashed potatoes. So like he had five loaded on him at all times. Like, where do you keep the food? Right? So he's got five Hungry Jacks spring loaded, and then he would just throw the rest of the food away, which is also funny because wherever he was, there was like a discarded Hungry Jack. But he would take that little wad of mashed potatoes and he'd be like, cool, here's a little unicorn, or here's like a drone that's going around the room and it looks like a bee of mashed potatoes that's following you, watching what you're doing.
I love how creative people can get with RPGs. How do you play the system for you guys? Because I know, just looking at it, your art is ridiculously amazing compared to, no offense, to many RPGs I see, where I see just blocks of text and I personally feel no need to read it. I am okay having other people do it and I'll play with them as long as I'm not the GM.
I don't blame you. I mean, it's just that's what we were kind of talking about a minute ago, the investment. Is it worth it? Hell yeah, but like not everyone's got a lifestyle that allows for it, right? Like you actually have to be like, sorry guys, can't go to lunch today. I got to read this book. Day and day again. Oh, I'd love to go see that movie, but I'm reading this RPG, you know, so there's a curve to it. Yeah, with Chu, so there's 60 issues of the series. So part of the deal of like licensing it from the creators is that we got all the comics. So the comics were all done at, you know, so we're geek out about graphic design, is that we're all done at 600 DPI. So that's like dots per square inch, like pixel style. So usually when you get art for like any sort of print copy, you know, you want the art at the resolution that it's being used to be at 300 or higher. It's just kind of like the standard. Beyond that, you start having no need, like the eye and everything. It just can't print to a higher quality of resolution than that. But with 600 means that like I can like double and triple the size and stuff of any little thing in any panel of 60 comic book issues and use it for like a 2-page spread. The beauty was, it was funny too, because we talked about Rob, who Rob did every single piece of art you see in all of the role-playing game and all of the comics and, you know, just the machine turning it out. And their art style is like what you're crediting, is that it's incredible. And you may not even catch it, but people who read the comics, like the world building he did in his art by just little things of like, you know, you see a pack of what would be Mentos and it said Stankos, you know, you'd see a buffet and it'd be like, wait for the diarrhea. And it was just little fun things that kept the humor and the feel and the zaniness and the vibes. But also sometimes when it was like meant to be graphic and dark, there'd just be things in there. Like they would, maybe you'd see a reflection of the person with the killing knife in the blood. So yeah, we were so fortunate with Rob. And then I literally was like, who are the best graphic designers? Like, because I got an IP with this, we know we're going to make some money. If I'm not going to do it now, when? Right. So I reached out. I literally made like this list and was working from like the top down of like graphic designers of just some of them were people who were like obscure that I was like, oh, they're incredible. And then some were like, hey, this person did all the Lord of the Rings stuff or whatever. And I got to Federico Sanz, who's a publisher and a game designer, a creator all of their own. They approached him with it, you know, just out of the blue, and they took it on. And with an incredible graphic designer and all of this art to use, like you said, when you flip through the pages, and the second book is even prettier because we like got to use more of the new art that had a lot more colors and had more of the fringe space stuff and, you know, weird portals to places and all, you know, like crazy stuff that so that it is like it's more vivid. But yeah, the art is incredible. And every 2-page spread, there's different layouts. It's not like a rinse and repeat template. We were just very fortunate that way. You know, you mentioned that game design, and I'll get us rolling in that direction. So it's a Forged in the Dark game. So people who've played Blades in the Dark, the system is based on that. For if you're really geeking about game systems, which you might if you're listening to this podcast, is John Harper made Blades in the Dark as kind of their own tweak to the Powered by the Apocalypse system made by Vincent Baker. So there was like years where that was the hotness on Kickstarter and crowdfunding was everything was Powered by the Apocalypse. Forged in the Dark in some ways, probably not by the biggest fans like over there, you know, was like almost like a spiritual successor, right, in some ways. So John Harper brought a little more OSR to it, some more like tables of roll a D6 or a D66, and here's some randomness, and, you know, stuff to kind of like help you fly at the seat of your pants. And Magpie, for example, with Avatar, everything they make is Powered by the Apocalypse. So give you a, you know, frame of reference.
Yeah, no, definitely. So then was there any additional like components that you put into it, or was it just a book?
I'm a true believer in like, you know, most of the time, like when I talked to the creators at the beginning, they're like, could we use this system? Is there another system that would be faster or, you know, whatever? And I was like, guys, everything sings with its own system. You know, you need something just matches like that. It can peek at the right things that you need a game system that is true. Right. We definitely added a lot of elements to Forge in the Dark to tweak it for Chew. And there was reasons why that brought us there. Leading from that is one of the biggest things we brought. We actually have a game board. We call it the Conspiracy Board. And it's a 6-fold, 10 by 14, I believe. Maybe it's 10 by 12, but it folds out to like 20 by 30. It'll take up most round tables, and it's all dry erase. And it's meant to look like an evidence board like you'd see on TV. It's recommended that you use Post-its and dry erase markers. And what it does is it helps the person who's running the game, who starts off playing your boss, because every session starts and ends with your boss, because your boss is like the true villain of Chew, because like anyone else you could put behind bars, but like you always have to go back to your shit boss. It starts with them giving you the case, right? And in the case, like you kind of have, as you play the story of the one shot or the campaign, it'll start with like, hey, who's the suspect? How'd they do it? The method? And what was their motive behind it? And in true Chew fashion, you don't actually have to get to the bottom of it. You just have to come up with some answer of your own for those three things. Because at the end of the day, you could blame it on like the airport car lender guy that sucked dick. Maybe I went too far at that. But you know what I mean? Like you can really, at the end of the day, pin it on whoever you want and you go back to your shit boss and hear about it later. So the conspiracy board allows the play in between to be very collaborative. It allows no one to worry about like, what was that clue? What happened at that one place? Because if it doesn't matter enough to the players to put it on the board, it doesn't even matter to continue going in that direction. And it allows them to guide the game master in directions of where they're taking their own case and their own story, because they don't have to get to the bottom of whatever you had in mind. They just have to kind of like connect it to somebody who was along the path of whether it's the mastermind behind it all or some, you know, grunt along the way that they feel like needs to be behind bars. So it's fun, and it leads to all kinds of crazy stuff. Like, we had a game where, like, I have these sticky notes that somebody in character creation was like, well, it says that I have, like, a podcast or a blog or something, conspiracy blog. And they were going on about, like, how they had this show, and it was, like, this foodie show or whatever, like a food, you know, a critic show. And they were losing viewers. And, I mean, they're just going on. Like, in the background, it's like other people are playing and whatever and building. And the player next to them, this is a convention game, so they didn't know each other, like, built out this whole playlist because they were touring on the side of their van, showing that they were calling, they had the Feed Me Bitches musical, that they were actually, like, their side gig was they were, like, promoting this musical that they were going to do as part of their TV show. Mind you, it has nothing to do with their actual play, right? But there's this work-life balance. And they wrote 3 acts worth of songs on Post-it notes that are all food-themed. It was hilarious and ridiculous, and I love when I get stuff like that, or little mementos that, you know, you get to keep and hold on. So we got the board. There's character sheets that are pads that are cool that you can pull off. Some of them, we wanted to not only have portrait pictures, there's pre-gens of the cast from the comics, but there's, you know, portrait pictures because every one of the playbooks, kind of like the class types, are based on different characters, right, from the comic. And we have some that have, like, loose sketches, so you could really make it your own to kind of inspire people to draw. Because sometimes that blank box doesn't do you enough. But we have chicken bucket dice sets. So obviously a world where there's a poultry prohibition, there are chicken buckets from Mother Cluckers, who is the brand of chicken that goes out of business in the comics. It's like the KFC. This is like your last chance to get a bucket of Mother Cluckers. When the dice mechanics, you want sixes, right? So all the sixes have chicken on them, and it's fun. And I never thought it'd be as cool as one of the first group of people actually played with them, and they were playing like Yahtzee with it, and they were like dumping the cup upside down and lifting it up and screaming chicken, and, you know, they got sixes. I should have filmed it. I literally stopped them and was like, I should have filmed this. I just should have filmed all of this. This is crazy. I just never thought, you know. I thought it was just shameless promotional dice, you know what I mean? So
you're enjoying the moment.
Yeah. So there's 2 books. There's the conspiracy board. There's the pads. There's the dice. Some dry erase markers and stuff and some pens and things. But that's the core of it. And of course, like, if you're a hardcore RPG person, you're playing online. We're still working on the Roll20 tools, but they're coming. But, like, you can use any kind of whiteboard. It could even be, like, piece of paper or poster board. You know, it's just fancy to have the dry erase board, right? And something you could fold up and with all your post-its on it, like, literally put it away so the next game, when you come back, you could lay it out and almost use it as, like, a refresher, right? Like, oh, yeah, this happened and then that, and we connected these two people. And it's really cool case to case, because you start then blending elements from the first case to the second case to the third case, and the players kind of create the overarching conspiracies that are the campaign arcs based on, like, what they piece together and where it goes.
So then how did you decide, or I guess reach out and get the IP for Chew in order to work on this project?
I have a very beautiful life.
Okay.
I do way too much by myself, which is the fault of all of us, I guess. Leading into Rest in Pieces, which, mind you, was COVID at the time. Like, it was summer, like, heart of COVID. Everyone's still locked down and, like, you know, at home. And some people are starting to have to go back to work and whatever. And I was like, okay, well, this Kickstarter for Rest in Pieces, yeah, I should probably put it off. But, like, I already know Chew's coming, and I'm not going to put off Chew by pushing this till next year. And then that, you know, whatever. I was like, this has just kind of got to happen now. Like, it's not the best time for, let's play in person. Let's play a role-playing game that needs Jenga, right? When everyone is celebrating. It's so cool. You play role-playing games from home. You don't lose anything. And I'm here playing Jenga. You can't even be around each other. So I brought on a friend of mine as a social media manager. They're kind of a miracle worker. For anybody who might know Mitchell Wallace, Mitch Bastios, sometimes he goes by now. He had talked to Rob. He was a big Chew fan. He liked Rob's work, and the Mitch magic was that he was like, oh, this one group of people, Helmgast, that makes this game. They were working on, gosh, I can't think of the name, but it's some kind of 60s, the Troubleshooters. It's kind of like, it looks like Tintin, but it's like 60s kind of James Bond. It's very cartoony and, like, wholesome looking. They were talking to Mitch about, like, hey, you know anybody who could do some art or something? And he was like, I think I should reach out to Rob Guillory of Chew, because I love that comic. Long story short was that it led to why is there a Chew role-playing game? And, oh, yeah, well, that'd be cool. But, like, you know, you don't sound like you've made enough stuff yet to, like, let you do it. And he's like, I know a guy. So I just happen to be working for him right now. And he's great. He could do, you know. So it was really cool. And then, you know, I got the business head and shoulders. So I was like, all right, guys, here's a, you know, comparable games and crowdfunding. And here's what I'm thinking for products and prices, and, you know, all that good stuff. And they're like, cool, let's do it. That was back, like I said, this is like 2020. So it's been a while, like at least conceptually, signing paperwork and contracts and stuff. The Kickstarter was at the end of 2021. You know, those books, like you said, and the kind of love that we gave to it, like it was a labor of love. So, and a lot of people, like that graphic designer, like they were working on it for years. It's funny, like I heard the Home episode, and the Home episode with Doug Lewandowski and Jules, and they brought up how a game design was like measured by the age of their children. You know? So I got a little bit of tea as my kiddo's six. So there's some elements of that as well.
That was kind of the, I shouldn't even say like inspiration, but the getting the contract and the opportunity to it being out was about 6 years.
It's funny because I know this, we kind of talk about this a smidge like beforehand. A lot of this I couldn't do myself because I like knew I got a little kid. Like I don't have the time, and I can't go sit in the office for 14 hours and like methodically go through all of the things that I need, because I know me too, and I'm kind of slow when it comes to it all. Like I really want to like dwell on it and stare at it for a while and ponder. And I've gotten so much faster now because I had to over the years. Yeah, eventually there's parts of this that I really had to just do all the work of in some areas, is you know, because like every project, there's things that fall apart or staffing issues and things that happen. But it's all here, and it's glorious. The core book won in any last year. One of the judges said it was the best to show, and like that's the coolest thing in the world.
Wow, that's so amazing for you guys.
That's part of why you do it all, to go all the way, you know what I mean? So it's just like, maybe one day I could win in any. It's neat.
Did you find that you made a lot of changes through the development of the game? I know you kind of mentioned how you tweaked the general system that you started with.
Yeah, like we had goals. There wasn't a lot of like, oh, we got to go back to the drawing board or this isn't working. There was, you know, especially with such a long development cycle, there were definitely things that changed over the course of it. It's funny now looking at it because, you know, these are like things that were like still 2 to 3 years ago for the most part, you know. The first year, in a lot of ways, there was a lot of things that just were supposed to be getting done, but everyone on this team that I put together for it was a designer. So they all had other crowdfunding projects of their own and the commitments, and every single person involved was wrong. There was, and this is common, you know, like, and I'm not trying to blame everyone, but it's one of those things where you just end up with everyone like was a year late on their own Kickstarter. So of course, then like, if they're all the pieces of this, right? So there was just so many things that happened like that. A lot of the game design changes were kind of like in the middle of that process. By the time we got to the second book, there wasn't like anything, and it was changes. It was just like, oh, here's some of the tweaks and additions that we had, you know, maybe honed it a little more. But there was probably like 2 or 3 years ago, there was like post Gen Con, there was a few more tweaks that were like, because we could.
How did the IP feel about the game when it came out? Were they like super excited? Did they play it a lot? Were they RPG people, gamers? Like, tell me about that.
So, like I said, I was talking to Rob the other day. I usually talk to John because John's the writer, and he was kind of, you know, he was almost like the adult for this project because Rob was so new when this happened. Like, Rob's gone on to do their own huge series and all kinds of work for, you know, writing and creating their own comics and all kinds of things. But this was the one where, like, hey, this guy's bringing me on. People really like this thing. And, you know, they were deferring a lot to John, who had been around for a while already, and while they did all the art. So, John Lehman and Rob Guillory. John is, you know, like written for now a lot of stuff, but like DC and Suicide Squad and Marvel and all kinds of stuff. He was the one who had played a role-playing game before. He actually worked on Champions Online. He went out to like Washington State or whatever and was working on the MMO that's based on, you know, the old Champions Super RPG. He took that money, you know, because video game people get paid a bunch of money and then they all get cut. Like, that's how it works. It's like 3 or 4 years of your life. You work 90, 100 hours a week. They pay you 100, you know, six figures. And then they're like, see ya. Three of us are going to stay here to be the company and the 400 of you, good luck.
Oh my gosh.
Because they just, that's, it's kind of cutthroat, but that's what the cycle is. So afterwards, he's like, man, I got all this money because I didn't have time to spend it. I think I'm going to go make this weird comic of my own. So with that, he hadn't played an RPG in years. But one of the reasons we have those chicken bucket dice is because John was like, oh, I kind of like dice. You know, I got some over here in my office and they got some here. I said, cool, we'll do something. We'll make some dice. You know, we'll do something. I don't know if they're going to play it. I could be wrong because Rob was already like, hey, I got a couple friends that are huge RPG people. And, you know, and now that they're getting it all, like maybe, I don't know, maybe they'll be like, you got to play it. And he's going to be like, okay. you know, like with role playing, you know, a tabletop anyway. It also matters just if you have the people.
Yeah, that's my problem with RPGs is so often it's like a thing that you have to meet up every week for a certain amount of time with the same people and everyone's schedules are rough. But I know like my editor Amanda was telling me that something she loves about your game is you can set it up to be just like a one shot, or you could set it up to be a campaign, which gives it flexibility.
You're speaking to the choir. One of the biggest things that I'm kind of known for now is I do a lot of convention retail, and I have for years. I curate selections of role-playing games, and I'm always trying to find, like, why aren't people role-playing, and, like, what answers I can give them. So there's been a lot of stuff, even for Rest in Pieces, right? This is a one-hour game. Drop and play. You could read the 20-page, you know, half-art example of play thing in the little instruction booklet and go play in 15 minutes, whatever. And it's so tactile, like, you don't even really have to know the rules. Just kind of pull blocks and go fun. My first game was all about really setting it up so you could play right away, but like really segmented so that if they only played one chapter, it'd be really fulfilling. It'd be like a chapter in a book, right? It would have a book end and like a good place to stop. And because it built a lot of like investment from the players, because they kind of designed what they were going to play and then kind of knew, oh, this is going to be three sessions because of how we designed it. So they kind of hooked themselves. That was part of like the teeth of the mechanics, was like, how do I get people to like give the game master exactly what they want to do with the right people, and then go, it's cool to make games so that people could have them their shelves because they're pretty, but you want them to play them, right? So I try to make every game accessible. This one is a little different. I mean, obviously we've played hundreds of like convention like one shots, and people are like, oh, that's incredible, it's incredible. And I've played, you know, a bunch of like 2 hour games for like ACD kind of stuff. We didn't do ACD, but you mentioned earlier like Gamma Expo. We found ways to do it like in 15 minutes, like little just like scenes that are strong, right? That like to get the feel. But yeah, if you don't have any answers, it's so hard. Everything in this world is like vying for your time. And nobody's got extra time, so you're just trying to make it so that everyone, when they're ready and they just happen to be together, cool, pull out Rest in Pieces. Oh my gosh, have you seen Chew? Look at this, it's hilarious. And people are like, yeah, can we play? There's some pre-gens, there's some adventures in the book. Yeah, you still kind of, like a role-playing game, somebody had to have read it, right?
Totally. I know you've kind of mentioned a few fun experiences, but do you have like a favorite and a least favorite experience in the design journey of this game?
Oh, now you're getting me. Favorite and least favorite. It's funny because my wife was like, there was a year there where she's like, you always used to talk about game design problems. Now all you talk about is staff.
Okay.
So my head goes there, right? So we don't need to go in there. But yeah, it's just funny that like with design issues, especially like as you grow from being an independent designer or even self-publishing, like you start growing, there's the growing pains of like, yeah, we're stronger together, but there are new elements and new challenges, and you get better at that too, right? Like we all could be better communicators, so I'm always learning stuff. But yeah, so I naturally kind of go there. There were some things where obviously as a game designer, I kind of mentioned this earlier, I really didn't feel like I would pick a game design that was already existing, like Forge in the Dark, like a system. And a little bit of that maybe also, I was talking to a new friend of mine that I kind of admired, one of the Forge, like our early indie early 2000s people, and he was like, why'd you use Forge in the Dark? And, you know, because he was kind of geeking out at Rest in Pieces. And I was like, yeah, you know, honestly, I kind of sold out a little bit. And I got these good reasons, but it's another community you grab. You get Forge in the Dark community. You get the Chew community. Rest in Pieces, like we were saying, I was pitching that, crowdfunding it during COVID. That October, you know, you do in October, right? Because you got death and Halloween themes and whatever it feels. And that was right before the election. So that was a tough Kickstarter. A lot of people who buy games had checked out of Facebook and checked out of Twitter because they were sick of political, and they'd been locked in their homes with social media being their primary way of contact for months. At this point, some of them were checked out again. They were like done with it. So there was a little bit of, gosh, I got to make sure this one does well. I have really good reasons, and I'm really proud of what we did with Forge in the Dark. And it's really cool because I like Blades, which is the core game of what Forge in the Dark was. And I love John Harper's work. So there's a lot of great things, but like just to drop some is like we added this approaches thing that's incredible. The playbooks fit really well, but like we switched them to be more like type of personality, right? And then there's one of the things in Chew is it never pulls its punches. Like each comic that you read, you feel like, what are they going to do next? They never are like brooding. They're never like going on and on and on, which is so refreshing because you're always like, that was incredible. They went from 0 to 60 and they finished in one issue, like, because nobody does that, right? Everyone's always like hoarding their good stuff kind of. Well, one of the things that they do is like, so sometimes there's people who like brutally die. They could be building them for a while and like, you know, horrible things happen. But like, it also makes you, again, more invested because you don't know what's going to happen, right? They're not going to like always save the day or get away with things. So one of the things, like, they have a resistance role. There's some player agency involved where you can kind of like describe something horrible happening to a player character. And then the player can be like, can spend a resource to kind of pull it back. But then in Chew, on like the core game, that can be a little more forgiving with it. You kind of know if this keeps happening, though, even for how lighthearted and zany and comical things can be, it can be really punishing. And it really leads you to the thing that's funny, again, is you might go to your boss, blame the wrong person, just to kind of like, hey, this case got way too hot. Let's go fishing. Fuck it. So I like that, too, because at the end of the day, these incredible cases are just your job. Not all of you are like actually hardcore heroes about it. It's not the power fantasy. Some of you are like, dude, if Rick, who is like the stepdad to my kid, because, you know, like the relationship didn't work, and now this stepdad is like always taking my kid everywhere and buying him everything, you know, that could be the B plot that supersedes the A plot of the game, as you're always worried about what Rick's doing with your kid. And I love that there's this element of Tropic Thunder almost, like, that is in every game of Chew, baked into every character, are these ridiculous troubles that people have. We were able to take a lot of the core mechanic things and do really fun things that felt uniquely Chew.
Sounds like you really took the comics, definitely did a deep dive, and made sure to find the right mechanics to partner up with it.
And the people who love the comics. Each book has like 40 factions, has like 40 places from the comics. And then, of course, with all that, we have all kinds of like hooks that are there to kind of help you, that if you want to like introduce them into your game or your campaign arcs, even as they'll progress in the background for their own goals that are kind of leading. And then it's cool because the mashup of the 2 to 3 you might be using for your game, they're all kind of developing as time goes on. But the people who know the comics will see all kinds of things, from the jealous assassins to the take of the Yakuza to the different agencies to the pasta transformers. And most people are like, oh, let's just check out this game, looks cool. The core book's got so much content, but both books like gets a ridiculous doubling of it, right? Like there's like 150 food powers and 3 different ways to make your own, all kinds of cyber technology, animal agents.
And for like designers that are trying to do something like this, do you have any pieces of advice for them for how to incorporate like an IP into an RPG?
It's so easy. So the first piece of advice is, don't do it because it's an IP. Do it because you love it. There are people who get IPs that, like, you know, maybe doesn't translate well, but they're going to be like, oh, but you know, this one, you know, they see the money or something, and they're not always money either, you know? There's been a few where I've seen, and I don't want to pick on anybody because, you know, it's a podcast, but there's been a couple where you're like, really? That one? Because when you think about it in this medium, that's not a group game, right? That's like a solo, because that's a movie, right? Like, that's a movie thing. It's the solo character. So if we have a group of people trying to do that, it gets really watered down. It doesn't feel like that whole core IP anymore, does it? Like, whether it was like Indiana Jones or something. Some of them don't translate like to the medium, and Chew's the opposite. And you're not going to get as lucky as Chew. We're like, Chew is so crazy and all over the place and had a little bit of it for everyone and was wild and funny and sometimes horrible and terrifying. But then you let players loose you know, with all that madness where they're not reading it passively. They're actually creating it. You know, it's a greater translation. If anything, you got to kind of be like, hey, creators of Chew, like, it'll be okay. It'll be okay because people are going to go nuts with your world. They're going to make crazier stuff than you could have imagined. And these people are going to all be, right, like you said, heroes or evil masterminds eventually. So, but they're going to make their mark because they're going to go nuts.
No, I was going to say, just from this conversation, I'm like, oh man, I've never read this comic or played the game, but I want to do both.
You have to. Yeah. And the first issue is free at image.com. When I first was like getting into it, I bought them all on Amazon. There's like 12 of the trade paperbacks. So it was like collect 5 at a time. But I wouldn't be doing the creative service if I didn't say they just released the Nombinus.
Okay.
It's like the omnibus, but it's Nom. They just released the 1,000 page book. That's the whole 60 issue series. And it came out like in March. So that's out there now too. I don't even know how much it costs, but I bought like, you know, the trades at like 10 to 12 bucks a piece. I don't mind buying used. I bought sets for some of the, you know, my friends who preferred print, who were, you know, working on the, like my editor and stuff. And this was so much fun to do. So advice was right. Like, and the same advice about talking about, like, you know, working on anything in game design, if it goes with IPs, do it because you like love the thing. Because there's nothing worse than making the thing that you don't want to make.
Oh, totally. It's just painful.
I get a lot of people like, why don't you do this 5e thing? Why don't you make some D&D stuff? I'm like, because I don't want to. I just don't want to. I love D&D, but there was a time and a place where I did that. And now I'm always trying to kind of innovate. Whether, you know, it might be in my head, but I'm always trying to innovate.
Oh, that's amazing. And do you guys have any other projects a fan should be looking out for?
Yeah, so we licensed Broken Tales from the World Anvil Publishing. So that was one of those, like, I saw it at Gen Con. It got nominated for a bunch of stuff. And I was like, hey, guys, you guys are in Italy. You got anybody selling it at Gen Con? I could help you with that. And it led to me being like, I backed it at one point, but then was like, hey, maybe we could do a print run. And then I licensed it as the publisher, you know, the U.S. publisher for like U.S. and Canada. It's really cool because it's based in fairy tales, but you play like the villains. And you literally play like the Pied Piper, the Big Bad Wolf, Baba Yaga, the Queen of Hearts, like these incredible characters. And it's like set in 1800s Europe. It's kind of a real world, but there was a yin and yang to the redemption of the villains because there was a child who went to the King of Fairies and was like, I wish that all the bad people could be good. And it made all the good characters in these fairy tales go insane. So you're almost playing like the Suicide Squad, like as a player, like a group of these actual villains like Captain Hook in a world that feels kind of real, 1800s Europe, with like, of course, superstitions and stuff. But then you go to the areas where there are these characters, like the City of Pigs is one of these scenarios where like the three little pigs, which are actually three guys wearing pig face masks who have like overrun a city with like they're rioting and everyone's running with pig face masks. It's so dark, but like also like it brings you in because the fairy tale stuff is like, it's relatable.
Yeah, you grew up with it.
The system is like one roll of like D6s that you can kind of push your luck with. So it's so narrative and it's like really designed in a great way with these characters all having like unique abilities that are really powerful that'll let you steal the scene. So you, as a game master, you don't have to worry about like making sure everyone gets their spotlight. They will take it because the game design's good. So anyway, we brought that on right before Chew. We have two more games that are like immediately coming up. And then we have like, you know, of course, like there's this whole bottleneck because of Chew of like other stuff that's like on the horizon. So I'm really excited about Memories Tomorrow. That's the sci-fi thriller we've been working on. That was like my COVID game. We started working on it during COVID when we couldn't go see people. It's got elements of trying to get to the core of like who people are and why they make the choices they make, which I think is the utter tip of immersion, right? Like when it comes to role-playing games of like each character has like memories that make them who they are, and their roles of how they do things are based on like how much they give a shit about certain ideals. So in a very simple fashion, like you're only as good as much as you care. And then I love the idea that you could be a person all about like logic or like really pushing like the definition or like how far people can go, like pioneering spirit or something. And then you have one memory that will, you know, you would always go that way. You're always about that one motivation, but then this part of you that like you saw like a world destroyed and you were on like the last refugee ship, you know, there's people banging on the door and you were like on this vessel where you like your hands touching their hand through the thing and your ship takes off and their world blows up kind of thing. And how that will change you because you'll never let that happen again to anyone. That's my next niche. But like at the same point, you know, like I everything we make is there right in that territory of it. It gives you the feels. It takes you somewhere. It tries to express something through its design and, you know, do cool things. For Mana Project Studios, last year I started working on the Ghost in the Shell role-playing game. So I'm the designer. That's been totally stalled by Kodansha. We have the quick start and we're still waiting on certain kinds of approval, but that's coming. So that's fun too.
Hell yeah. All the good things. Well then, for my last question, unrelated to everything Chew and everything we've been talking about, what game do you wish you had designed had you, I don't know, chosen Monopoly or something else to magically be the designer of?
I'm self-sabotaging right here because I have to like be like, hey, my quick answer is because I knew this was coming because I listened to episodes.
Yeah.
So Monsters and Other Childish Things was made by, it was designed by Greg Stolze, and there's a guy named Benjamin Bow that I hope I said his name right. It might be Bow. That did some really cool game design on it. It was made by Arc Dream Publishing. I don't remember. I think this is like kind of like the 2000s. I used to go to Gen Con every year and be like, okay, Pete, you can buy two games. Like every year, get two games, right? Just like to kind of make some method to the madness because I would go every year. And especially back when I was like in college or college age and had no money, you know, you'd be like, okay, well, I won't use four games. They're just some go on the shelves. So one year I bought Monsters and Other Childish Things. And it is kind of like Cthulhu meets like South Park. You play kids that can be like elementary to high school, and you all have your own monster. So there's some fun different ways to do that. But like, it's just got a great, easy, approachable system that makes you feel like, and even the writing and the look of the pages and the layout is just so incredible, and how it transfers like the feel and the vibe, being like a little bit creepy, but at the same point, always having that like snarky kid South Park element, even if it's more Calvin and Hobbes, because it's like me and my monster. And the creativity of how they simplified making your own monster to let you make anything and anything possible. Like, oh, my monster is actually like this living black hole that comes out of candy bar wrappers. You make the bits, the parts of the body parts, which can be anything you want, but you got to have like at least two. And you assign so many dice to them, which, and then the dice can either be like dice to roll or dice to like, dude, you buy abilities with them and stuff. And the game, the characters were just built by like your head and your feet and your hands are the attribute. Because like, what part of your body, because your kids doesn't really have to be that scientific. And then what skill do you do with it? And that's like the number of dice. But I have this little thing too of like, your relationships matter. Because you're a kid, you could pull on things. Well, mom told me that if I eat my Cheerios and if I just try hard, I can do whatever I set my mind to. And you can pull dice from that pool like when you need to, but you kind of have to like explain it. And then if you fail, it like creates a crisis with your relationship with that you and that person that has to be like healed and dealt with to get those dice refilled and fixed again. Or of course, it goes great, but it brings elements of like crisis into relationships. And so it's building relationships as well. And then you and your monster is incredible because your monster like doesn't ever want you to get hurt, but like could be shot by a nuke and not die. But like if somebody insults you enough, it hurts them.
Aww.
So it's a beautiful game. And Greg Stolze designed it and he knows how much I think it's great. And it uses like pairs, you roll D10s. But like how it breaks down that if you have a pair of 10s, it's much more precise because it's 10s than a pair of 2s. So in some cases, a pair of 10s is much better than like 5 3s. And it's just neat that you're always with one simple roll of a handful of dice you're looking at. You know, you get all this kind of stuff you can read out of it. So there is the Welcome to Night Vale. So for years, there's been people who I was like, I would like to make Welcome to Night Vale. But use the one roll system from, because I saw if we could do that, but in Monsters and Other Childish Things, I wanted to do it for years. And then I don't know if I've ever had a moment where I heard like Renegade launch the, you know, Welcome to Night Vale crowdfunding campaign on Backerkit. And I think every time I heard anything about it, it kind of hurt my soul. but it was like, what, I didn't even know I would feel that way, you know, but it was funny because I there were people who I was like, you know, I always wanted to do Welcome to Night Vale, but with this thing. So thank you for that question, because I love those questions. And like, it lets me give some shine on the game that like, there's again, sometimes I meet people and they're like, yeah, that game, and we geek out about it, but it just does, you don't hear enough about it. Arc Dream's got a lot of titles like that are just like Puppet Land that like are so good, but people are sleeping on them. Everyone knows Delta Green, so like that's what they're known for, but.
No, that's really cool because I had no idea. So maybe I need to get them on the podcast.
Is there an episode where I get to hear your answer to that question?
There's been times where people have asked me. So yes, I have said it.
Okay, so I got to dig.
You got to dig. Well, it's more also because I have been asked. So now what I do is I instead give it for like a different category or something.
Oh,
so.
Gotcha. Yeah, because you got to keep it rolling. You don't want to be like, nah, I already did it.
Exactly, because so many people have already heard me say the same answer. Yeah, I always say my like number one is Wingspan for many reasons, but... For this one, I was like, actually, RPG-wise, since I haven't played all that many, Kids on Brooms is probably my answer for the ones I've played. It was very, like, approachable for me as a newer person and a theme that, like, I felt like I could relate to because, you know, I, like, grew up watching all those kinds of, like, witchy vibes and, like, kids walking around and, like, roaming around like E.T., like, biking around with an alien or whatever, so.
It's a great, I just knew Kids on Bikes. I followed the rest of them because, you know, like, we mentioned Doug earlier. Shout out to Doug Lewandowski. But, you know, I actually see Jonathan Gilmore all the time.
Oh, cool.
I shouldn't say all the time. It's not like we're not neighbors or anything, but I see him, like, you know, multiple times a year, so, like, I actually see him, but, like, Doug... I've seen Doug like twice ever. So then when I see Doug, I'm like, holy shit.
Yeah, the two of them are super talented and also just great human beings.
Yeah, Jonathan's wonderful.
Always a plus. Well, for everyone who's been listening to this episode, I'd like to thank you for joining this episode of Game Design Unboxed, Inspiration to Publication, episode 120, Chew. And Peter, this was great having you on. I had a lot of fun talking, and I'm definitely going to be going on Amazon and buying some things after this. for anyone trying to find you or the company, how do you get found online?
Yeah, so pretty much Imagining Games. Sometimes it's going to be like at Imagining Games, usually one word, right, like run on. But if you go to imagininggames.com, you could find the social links there too. It's been weird because like I was on X and Facebook and Instagram, but like X, obviously, I was like, I really need to move to Blue Sky because that's where everybody is. And so I've just been dead on X is really what it is.
Same.
I've been getting back into the Facebook and Instagram at least weekly. Do you find that like as a creative, it's like that's the one area that sometimes I'm always like, I'll hit it up again later. Like I always can put that one off, you know, like, cause I'm like, I'm really working on this right now.
And yeah. I'm good with like my Facebook and my Instagram. I'm okay at like, I'm good at my stories on Instagram. I am okay at posting on Instagram, and then Blue Sky is meh, and X is basically my ex at this point. I can relate to these things. And for everyone, this was your host, Danielle Reynolds. If you're looking to find me on social media, check out my Instagram and Blue Sky under the username TokenGamer, and that's spelled G-A-Y-M-E-R. And if you're looking for some fun short-form video tips on how to design games as well as learn more about your favorite games, please check out our Instagram and TikTok at Game Design Unboxed, as well as our website, GameDesignUnboxed.com. Once again, thank you so much for being on the show. This was great. Hopefully, I'll get to meet you in person.
Done, yeah.
Thank you for joining Danielle for another episode of Game Design Unboxed, inspiration to publication. If you'd like to hear more great gaming podcasts, check out NoDirectionPodcasts.com. And if you're looking for a great board game, bag, playmat, or table, check out AllPlay at LetsAllPlay.com. Join us next time.